Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. I am your host, Scott Wilson, blogger and graffiti writer extraordinaire. Welcome to tonight's edition of Scott Scope Talk Radio. On tonight's show, we're going to be interviewing filmmaker R.L. Scott, and we're going to be talking to him about his new film, Call Me King, which opens up September 4th, I believe. That's going to be our entire show. We're going to be, you know, having a conversation with R.L. about his latest work. And it's going to be me flying solo tonight. I'm not going to have, so it's just going to kind of be a one-on-one conversation. But it's definitely going to be one that I think a lot of people are going to want to tune in for. And without further ado, let me bring in R.L. Scott.
Hey, what's going on, brother?
How you doing, man? How you doing, R.L.?
I'm good, man.
You know, we had you on the show where we were talking to the creators of the Almighty Street Team, and it's definitely a pleasure to have you back. I consider you a friend of this show, friend of the blog as well. You know, me and you, we've talked before in the past, and this is really exciting to get to talk to you in this capacity instead of just having it be a casual conversation.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I've been looking forward to this, and also looking forward to the film coming out. So, this is really dope.
Okay. All right. Just for those who may not have heard the Almighty Street Team show, just kind of give people a quick rundown of who you are.
Well, it was five comic book creators who sort of got together and, you know, they all had sort of these independent books and these heroes that certainly could stand on their own. And, you know, I think they all met at a convention, if I'm not mistaken, like a comic book convention, and decided to sort of pull all their resources together and bring all five or six of these heroes together into one comic book. And I came across it maybe a few years ago online, and I was just instantly blown away by how rich it was, how cinematic it was. And I actually reached out to the guys. We sort of got together and began collaborating on adapting that comic book into a live-action feature film. So that's something that's currently in the works right now.
All right, so tell us a bit about Call Me King. What is it about?
Initially, it started as this concept I had back in maybe 2011. And at the time, it was about two brothers who were sort of trying to get out of London, sort of this harsh environment in London. And they were both of Haitian descent, essentially. That seed is what sort of grew into Call Me King. You know, it's something that that some people may know as To You Plan, which was a series, you know, that was sort of the beginning stages of what Call Me King ultimately became, you know. But yeah, it's about these Haitian brothers, these gun runners, and who work for the Italian mob, and you know, they sort of have their own ambitions and you know, their own goals, and they eventually clash with, you know, people, you know, some people from their past, their father and things of that nature. You know, I'm trying not to give too much away, but yeah, it was a genre that I really loved. I really loved the crime genre, and the action genre, and the crime genre. And you know, I felt like if it was something I was going to dive into, I wanted to sort of take a different approach than maybe we've seen in the past.
Okay. Now you mentioned Toy Pwin, which is something I covered that web series on my blog. That was one of the that was like, I think during the first year of the operation of my blog, or the first 2 years. I remember after speaking to you. Shout out to Jasmine Hester, who's a part of that web series.
Yeah. Shout out to Jasmine Hester, Tracy Dukes, you know, who were amazing in that.
No doubt. It definitely stood out from other such. It definitely stood out from a lot of other web series at the time, because you didn't really have anything like it. It's in a sense how this film sort of stands out, because, you know, you being a black filmmaker, there's sort of a stigma that comes along with that label. People tend to assume that there's a certain type of product that you're going to specialize in, and these days that tends to be sort of the, for lack of a better term, the sort of chitlin circuit relationship movies that Tyler Perry has made popular, or family dramas, you know, things of that nature. That's been big business. I mean, we're starting to see a little bit more diversity, but a lot of it is still along those lines. Whereas you are more, your work is more tailored to genre, crime, martial arts, things of that nature, and the influences are a bit different than, say, the influences in a Tyler Perry film, or a film starring Kevin Hart, one of the 20 or 30 films he's in right now. did that make it hard for you to get this film made?
Well, I will say that, you know, and I guess I have to speak to that in regards to my peers as well. I think that in a lot of ways, you know, the industry, which I do love, I'm certainly not bashing the industry in any way, but in truth, you know, there are certain guidelines that the establishment finds more favorable. You know, they tend to sort of put us in these particular boxes, and I think to some degree they would prefer we stay in those boxes, or we play in these particular boxes. And so for, I think, some of my peers, because there certainly are several of us who are doing things that are different. Myself, Xavier Kantz, who's another great filmmaker, Ben Ramsey, who's another great filmmaker. There are other guys that operate in the action genre as well, or in any genre that we choose. But I think that other peers of ours, you know, they sort of find like an easier way to go if you sort of play in a particular sandbox. And so, you know, if you want to kind of go the easier route, you know, one could fall into, you know, one of those traps, essentially. You know what I mean? And then you have to sort of think about what's really important to you. Like, what is your, as a filmmaker, what are you trying to say? What is your message? What do you want your legacy to be? What are you trying to say to the world? Or what are you trying to show to the world? You know what I mean? And so, you know, it could essentially be a tougher way to go. You know what I mean? If you're built for that route, then, or if you're going to go against agenda, quote unquote, it could be a bit tougher. But I think that with technology and with fan support, I think things have gotten better. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's gotten a little easier, but it is very difficult.
Times when people see a movie poster for a new crime film and there are black faces on that poster, they assume that it deals with street level crime.
Mm-hmm.
And but your movie doesn't deal with that. It's definitely organized crime, and in particular Haitian or Haitian American organized crime. Why that choice specifically, Haitian or Haitian American? What inspired that choice?
I think it was an angle that we hadn't necessarily seen before. We hadn't really tapped into it very much. I think oftentimes when we see ourselves in this particular genre, you know, we're usually wearing, you know, Timberlands and a hoodie, and, you know, we're usually at the bottom of the food chain. You know, we never make it into those meetings that really take place, you know, the meetings that sort of took the balance of power, if you will. And so for me, I truthfully wasn't interested in doing that. I felt like that had already been done before. And, you know, when you look at shows like The Wire and different shows like that, I felt like that was ground that had been covered before and covered extremely well in many different scenarios, many different circumstances. But I felt like this particular approach to have us be a little more traveled, to have us speak more than one language, to have us dress a certain way, and to ultimately have us be the alpha or the strongest force in that world, is something we just hadn't seen before. And so, you know, me as a filmmaker, I sort of thrive on originality as much as possible. It's very difficult to do something original because so many, you know, we've seen so much. But as often as possible, I try to do something that's outside of the box or approach things from a direction that maybe we hadn't seen before. And so, if I was going to do it, it had to be that way. It couldn't sort of tread over territory that we'd already seen before. You know, to me, that's not very appealing to me as a filmmaker to sort of do what's been done.
Okay, now speaking of treading over familiar ground, some people who see this movie may notice similarities to a very popular show that just wrapped second season called Power. Now, I've been down with you since day one. I've been down with what you're doing since day one, since the first episode of Toyi Pwin. And, you know, I know that you've been, you know, like, for you, this is something you've been doing for a hot minute. You didn't steal this idea from anybody. This is your baby. Now, on that show Power, the main character, he deals in drugs. But as you said, the what is the name of the crime syndicate in this, of Call Me King again? The Strap Set.
Yeah.
Forgive me, my brain was kind of malfunctioning. The Strap Set. They deal in guns.
Yeah.
Why the choice of guns over drugs?
Yeah,
because
it was
drugs would have been the easiest route to take.
Definitely. Sort of a similar motivation. You know, drugs, we'd seen drugs dealt 10 ways to Sunday, you know what I mean? And but we'd never really seen us operate in the world of gun running, you know, and enforcing in that way. So, yeah, it was just another thing where I just didn't want to kind of rehash something that had just been done so many times before. And ultimately, to me, it wasn't really, the movie wasn't really about the crime itself, but more about the relationships and the characters that sort of inhabit that world. And the crime aspect is more of a backdrop.
All right. Speaking of the crime aspect, there are little nuances in this film, and that's what my question, what this set of questions is kind of focusing on, because those nuances I find very interesting. Because with any artist, be they a filmmaker, a singer, rapper, whatever, I feel like the truth is in the details. That's the most interesting part. Now, when you look at this movie, it's set in Los Angeles, correct?
Well, it's sort of a city similar to LA. You know, we never necessarily say exactly where it happens, but that's because it can be any city, any major city. Yeah.
Okay. Well, all right. A city similar to LA, because there are little cues in this movie, and definitely if you look at the show Toy Quinn, that this crime syndicate, the Strap Set, is East Coast in its origins, maybe even particularly New York. That's something I've never really seen in a major motion picture before, the idea of New York organized crime moving in on West Coast organized crime, or having such a high place on the food chain. I mean, from what I understand about history, that was something like that was attempted way back in the day. The movie L.A. Confidential kind of deals with that, with Mickey Cohen and his mob. Why don't you talk to me a bit about that that choice in particular? How did you deal with that nuance?
Yeah, I really felt like I wanted to take a more of a global approach in the way that we present the film. You know, so these characters sort of originated essentially in New York. They sort of migrated, to LA or a city similar to LA. And they also had ties, you know, overseas and in different markets, in Russia and Haiti and in Asia. And so I've always taken a very global approach to everything that I do. I guess it's sort of a product of my upbringing, but just sort of my outlook on the world in general is that it's much bigger than where we are. I mean, it's much bigger than our neighborhood. It's much bigger than, you know, there's a whole world out there, you know. And so I'm very much interested in taking a global approach or an international approach to everything and showing different sort of sides and different facets to even us as people. And, to me, that's always just been more interesting to me. I think just foreign cinema had a lot to do with that. Just growing up, watching a lot of foreign cinema and being influenced by it. I just see the world as a much bigger place than, you know, just a localized view of the world and of us, you know.
Are you familiar with the organization known as Zopound?
Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm not.
It's a Haitian organization. They're very big here in the South Florida area, there's another show out right now called Money and Violence. You may have heard of it. It's a web series. Takes place in Brooklyn, Brooklyn, New York, and it deals with Haitian Americans. And the Zopound sort of ideology. The show has many allusions to that. So I was just kind of wondering because. There seem to be some of those same allusions here, but I kind of took it as you maybe drawing from real life, drawing inspiration from real life. But it added a sort of an interesting level to the show. Now, as far as As far as the you just mentioned the influences. You have a wide range of influences. I know that just by talking to you, and anybody can tell that just by looking at your work. There are similarities to like the Hong Kong New Wave with Call Me King, because it's a crime story, but it's told with lots of action, lots of gunplay, and lots of martial arts. And that kind of harkens back to the heroic bloodshed films of like John Woo and Ringo Lam, but it's also reminiscent of sort of the South Korean action cinema that is itself inspired by Hong Kong. What role did like the influences of Hong Kong and South Korea play in this film in particular?
I would say huge. I mean, you know, I'm certainly a huge fan of not only classic Hong Kong cinema, but Korean cinema as well. And very inspired by their ability to to tell unique and interesting stories that are also action films as well. There's always a lot more to those films in terms of, you know, it's not just like random violence. You know, there's always a unique approach to storytelling, and they're very inventive in that way. So, yeah, I would certainly say that there was it was a huge influence on me. You know, films like The Man from Nowhere, you know, films like Company Man, you know, and the list is just too long to even name. But yeah, especially Korean cinema. You know, I'm a huge fan of Korean cinema. And so I do think the two can sort of coexist. I think you can have a rich, interesting story, a multi-layered story, and also have action as well. I don't think that you have to separate the two. And I don't think an action film just has to be just mindless action. And then an intelligent crime thriller can sort of be separate. I think you can marry the two.
Okay, another nuance I noticed in this film in particular is your characters tend to talk a lot of times in terms of philosophy, to the point where many of them come off as very well-read. Especially the movie kind of, not to give away anything, the movie kind of opens on that note with the main character Reyes, is that pronounced correctly?
Yeah, right.
Yep, portrayed by Amin Joseph, and he sort of begins it. He sort of begins the movie on this note of he sees everything in historical terms, and also he uses the language of writers and philosophers of eras past. What influenced that choice?
For me, you know, it's the intelligence of a character and you know, having a character that's well-read, well-traveled is extremely important. I think that a lot of times in the industry, us as people, I feel like we, people of color, all people of color, we're not necessarily presented in the most intelligent way. I think a lot of times, you know, the stereotypical approach to who we are as people is what comes through more so than anything else. You know, we're usually labeled in one particular way or another, you know, as being either boisterous, angry, loud, ignorant, not very intelligent, not business people, not traveled, not able to have an articulate conversation. And it was important to me to sort of cut through that stereotype and present us in a way that I see us as people in the way that I feel that we should be presented, which is, you know, the opposite of all those stereotypes. You know, I feel like, you know, most of the people that I know that of people of color are highly intelligent people, and they do speak other languages, and they are very well read, and they have traveled, and I just felt like there weren't enough examples of those types of people, and I think that you know, a lot of we're often judged by the way the people, the way the industry depicts us. We're often judged by that, and I think it's completely wrong. And so, you know, I don't agree with it, so it's kind of up to me to do something about it, you know.
Yeah. Well, I actually found that choice very interesting, and also I found it to have a basis in truth, because I know with La Cosa Nostra, the Italian mafia, I know like Niccolo Machiavelli, the writings of Niccolo Machiavelli are like, in a sense, required reading for a lot of the bosses there, or maybe that's just folklore, I don't know, but I've heard those things brought up in the same breath, so to me that seems to be very in keeping with those traditions. And you're right, it is refreshing to see black characters along those lines. Was it hard? Because this movie kind of straddles many different genres, because a lot of people, at times it feels like a quote-unquote realistic crime drama, but then there are elements that are definitely fantastical that take it into the realm of like melodrama and action movies and martial arts films and stuff. Did you find it rough trying to maintain that balance and still keep the film sort of coherent?
Truthfully, I didn't. I think that you know, the work I had done in the past had sort of prepared me for it. You know what I mean? Because it's creating those types of images is something I really believe in. So no, I would say not at all. I didn't find it difficult to find that balance. I was sort of used to creating characters, you know, that speak a certain way or that present themselves a certain way, and it was interesting actually when I created the web series originally. I was more of a feature film guy. I'd never done a series before, and so I found it to be an interesting approach to this particular material. But at the same time, I found it quite limiting. Because the episodes had to be so short, you know, there were a lot of things I couldn't really present in terms of the characters. I couldn't really be as in depth as I wanted to be. And so, you know, myself, my business partner Amy Joseph, we sat down one night after the last episode of 2U Plan was released, and I was just like, there's so much more that I didn't get to say, you know. And so it was kind of at that point that we decided, you know, to take it into the feature film realm, which was a realm that I was more comfortable with. I had made feature films before, and I felt like it was a much bigger canvas to tell this story.
Okay. Now, this is receiving a theatrical release on Labor Day, right?
Yes, September 4th.
Or on Labor Day weekend, rather. I'm sorry, let me correct that. Labor Day weekend. Now, in securing a theatrical release for this film, did distributors take the stereotypical approach and try to market this film as like some kind of counter programming? Or is it simply are they simply releasing it just simply as a crime film or an action thriller?
Well, I'll say that there's actually two marketing teams on the film. One team sort of focuses on more of a ethnic demographic, and then the other focuses on sort of the action market. So. I do have to point this out. Uniquely enough, our distribution company is owned by an African American, so they certainly got us a little bit more, you know, they understood what we were doing, and you know, how important it was to us to sort of present these type of images. I'm pretty sure things could have gone another way. We did get several offers. We got a lot of offers on the film, and we did sort of run into a few unique challenges in terms of those particular distributors fully understanding what we were trying to do. You know what I mean? But yeah, we actually we landed at a good place, and yeah, so we were pretty fortunate this time around.
All right, I'm glad to hear that. You know, it's nice. It's always nice to hear when a black person is at the head of an endeavor like that, a film distribution. I mean, that's amazing. That's definitely what we need, because I think it was you who told me a few years ago, it's not just a matter of getting the film made. It's a matter of actually getting it in front of people, putting it in venues where it can be seen. And
yeah.
a lot of people don't understand that end of it. They think you can simply get, you know, even if you had $200 million to spend on a quote-unquote black film, that you just simply spend the money and make the movie and that's the end of it. No, there's a whole other aspect to this business that people aren't grasping.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of interesting sort of roadblocks there. You know, it's not impossible, but you do have to understand what you're up against and know how to navigate it, you know.
Now you have some fairly recognizable faces in this movie, and I got the IMDb page right in front of me, so I'm going to try to call out all of them. You have Gabrielle Dennis, who people will recognize from Game or particular seasons of The Game. You have Chris Mulkey, hope I'm pronouncing his name right, who plays Angelo in the movie. I've seen him a ton of places. I can't think of any of them right now, but he's a recognizable face. You also have Lester Spate, and he's on, you know, My Wife and Kids, as well as various other movies. I think he was in what was the movie Eddie Murphy did that caused all the controversy? Norbit. I think he was in that.
Yeah, Norbit. He's in the Transformers trilogy.
The Transformers trilogy, of course. How were you able to secure a fairly recognizable, you know, not just one, but like three or maybe even more recognizable names for a movie like this that doesn't have a huge budget?
Yeah, and also I would actually also like to mention Bai Ling, who's in the movie.
Yes, Bai Ling.
You know, she's been in The Crow and Red Corner and tons of films, and Bill Cobbs as well from New Jack City, and you know, a ton of other films as well. You know, interestingly enough, like they all responded to the material. You know, I think that was the thing that really got them to say yes, was the material, the writing, and the type of material we were presenting. And yeah, I would say that's what they really responded to. You know, it sort of all starts with the script. And for any filmmaker out there, aspiring filmmakers or writers out there, you'd be surprised who you can attach to your film if you have a great script, if you have a solid story and something that's really intelligent and something that may also challenge them as an artist or engage them as an artist. You'd be pretty surprised. So some of it was relationships that we had with those actors, and some of it was, you know, just sending the scripts to the agents, to them directly, and them responding to the material. But ultimately, they all said yes because of the material.
Now, there is a theme in this film, and one of the things I just mentioned, this concerns his character, the character of Angelo. In this movie, you have a scenario where the strap set, a Haitian-American crime syndicate, is basically going to take over the day-to-day operations of an Italian crime family. Again, not to give away too much, but that's a theme that is a recurring theme in a lot of blaxploitation from back in the day. I think that's where I first saw it anyway. You always saw this sort of tension between black gangsters and Italian gangsters and fighting over territory, this, that, and the third. Did any of those movies, say like Black Caesar, for example, did they provide inspiration for you, or did the inspiration for that particular element come from someplace else?
Yeah, I actually didn't. I didn't watch any black exploitation at all in regards to this film. I had seen, you know, some of it, but truthfully, I hadn't watched. I hadn't watched a ton of it. You know, so yeah, I wouldn't say it was a direct inspiration, but I'm sure that some of that DNA was in there just from years ago of watching those films and seeing sort of the ambition of those characters, you know, how they wanted something greater or to accomplish something greater. So I'm sure somewhere in the back of my subconscious, you know, there's some connection there, you know, maybe that, maybe Othello, maybe some other pieces of cinema that, you know, is sort of swimming in there somewhere, you know.
All right, I want to ask you a few broader questions, not about Call Me King specifically, but just, you know, being that you're a black filmmaker and I feel your insight into the filmmaking industry is pretty much priceless because it's not something that that the ordinary layman, guys like me, get to see under the hood. We don't get to really, we're not there for the meetings and business dealings and everything that goes on. We only see the finished product and we evaluate that, and from that we try to extrapolate what we think might have gone on behind the scenes. Now, earlier you spoke to, you answered my question as to some of the stigmas facing black filmmakers these days. Now, I've heard Atlanta described as black Hollywood, and I have a lot of friends who are actors and such who have relocated to Atlanta trying to break into the film industry, where they've had a hard time doing that in places like LA or even New York. In your opinion, is Atlanta a viable alternative to Hollywood, or is that sort of a new mythology?
I personally wouldn't say that it's a viable alternative just yet. I think it has grown quite a bit. I think that they're doing a lot of business in those areas in Atlanta in terms of you know, being able to cash in on you know, certain incentives, which are great, but ultimately LA is the hub of the industry. It is where the deals are made, and it's where, you know, at least in my experience, you know, because I've lived in Atlanta for a few years and I moved here, and this is the hub. I definitely think it's growing. I think. But I think the moves are essentially made here. And I think from here, when those films are sort of already locked in place and they have their stars and they have, you know what I mean, then they go out there and they shoot. And so I think honestly, there's more extra work there. I don't know if in Atlanta you can become a star. I'm not saying you can't, but I don't know if you're gonna get the type of attention that you would get here, in terms of you know, being looked upon as a major contender in the industry. I really feel like, but I do feel like it is growing. Like I said, I think it is growing. I think there's some nice opportunities there. But yeah, this is where it really happens. So I don't think it's there yet. You know, I think there's this one Hollywood right now. You know.
Now, in terms of, like, okay, right now, the biggest story probably in black film is the success of Straight Outta Compton. You know, it just, this past weekend, it crossed the $100 million mark. And from what I've read, I read an article by Scott Mendelson, who writes for Forbes magazine. He's kind of like their critic and also like their box office analyst. And he said that it's currently en route to become the biggest grossing film all time by a black director. The first scary movie currently holds the title as the highest grossing film ever by a black director. Do you see that as a good or a bad thing, or none of the above? Like, what do you think that means for the future of black cinema?
I definitely think that. I'll start by saying, I thought the film was great. You know, and it's definitely good to see a film with leads that are not only black, but they're unknown, and see it do so well. Even though, you know, NWA, of course, is a well-known entity in American history. You know, it's definitely a piece of American history, but these actors are unknown, and I think it's amazing. Oftentimes what happens is then you see this sort of influx of, you know, anything that does well in Hollywood, usually there's like a string of copycats that go, we want to do just what they just did, or we want to make one of those, you know, that type of thing. So we will probably see an influx of these type of films for a good 3 years coming up. You know, we'll see, which is great, because there's going to be work for a lot of really phenomenal actors of color. So that's great. You know, it's sort of been those same arguments. Year after year after year after year after year. We constantly have this this black films don't travel, black films don't do well overseas, all these arguments, you know, and those we continue to shatter records, we continue to show that that's not the case, but the conversation doesn't change. And so I'm hoping that maybe this time, you know, things will be taken a little more seriously. You always hope that that's the case. I don't think a lot of those older entities in control of Hollywood, I don't think there'll be a massive change, truthfully. I think there'll be an influx, a quick sort of boost of that type of content. They'll go, wow, that's a market that we may have overlooked for a little while. You know, let's milk that audience clean. And, you know, once there's no more money to be had in this particular place, then we'll move on to something else, you know, that type of thing. But I'm definitely happy for everyone involved in that. It was interesting watching that film, because I know so many people in the film, and you know, that was really cool to see everybody up there. And
shout out to Marcus Taylor.
Shout out to Marcus Taylor.
Real good brother. I've spoken to him on Facebook chat a couple of times. And I'm just glad to see that he's getting exposure and getting work. He's been putting in a lot of work that people don't know about. Sons of Anarchy, other shows and movies. So I'm really happy for him.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. To see him get that opportunity was absolutely amazing. I told him years before that he had something. You know what I mean? That he had something special, and it's just awesome to see it come to fruition. And so yeah, that was really cool. I don't know if it ultimately will tip the scales in a major way, but I think for a short time, for a small period of time, it's similar to like the Raid, you know. It came through with unknown actors and it just electrified people, and it tips the scales for like a few minutes. Oh, we want a Raid type movie. We want something like the Raid. We want a Raid style fighting. We want, you know. So you get that sort of thing, you know, when something is successful. That's sort of a natural byproduct in the industry that people want to sort of copy that same success.
Now, question about you're a guy who's very skilled at working with relatively small budgets or low budgets and turning in a quality product. Do you think, like looking at Call Me King after, you know, you've wrapped production and now that the film is set for release, do you look at it and say to yourself, man, if I only had more money, this scene could have been that much better, or this element could have been that much better? Say if you had, you know, the $29 million that they say Straight Outta Compton cost. If you had had that at your disposal, do you think that the film would have turned out any better, or do you think that quality is not attached to the budget?
I think that, you know, of course, ultimately, if you have more money, you know, you can do more. You can, you know, it's gonna be a means of getting your vision out in a bigger capacity, in a bigger way. I don't think that a filmmaker should think in terms of limiting himself with money. I don't think that the dollar amount should determine your creativity or how you set out to make a film. I think that you should always try to push beyond what you have monetarily. You should always try to push past whatever that dollar amount is. But yeah, ultimately, you know, there are things that, you know, you learn to let those things go, but, you know, naturally there are things that you wish you could do, or if you could have had more time, or you could have had this, or you could have had a yacht instead of a speedboat, or you wish you could have blew up a building instead of, you know, set a box on fire or whatever, you know, whatever the case may be. But yeah, you know, once you've sort of done all you can with what you have, like at some point you have to just let it go and stand and be what it is, and you know, you're constantly growing, you're constantly evolving, but it is important to be able to show your worth and show your value to the industry, and I do think especially if you're an ethnic director and you're doing films that are sort of against agenda, you definitely have to know how to make every dollar count. And really, it doesn't really depend on what race you are, truthfully. I think that it's just smart to be very conscious of whatever budgets you do get. You know, be very smart about how you use them and try to maximize what's on the screen. You know, at the end of the day, nobody cares if you had caviar and lobster on the set. You know, it's like, it's all about what's on the screen. And, you know, the more budget you can put on the screen, you know, the better off you'll be. And I just sort of come from that world because I started filmmaking very early. You know, I started writing, directing at 15. And based out of necessity, you know, I had to be very conscious of how I spend money in order to create, you know. So that's just something that naturally carried over as I grew up and the budgets got larger, you know. And I'll always be that way. If I have a $100 million budget, I'm still going to be very conscious of how I use it, and I'm gonna work to make it look like $200 million.
Now, this journey that you that kind of began with Toy Pwin, and it continues now with Call Me King. It's become fairly clear to me that these characters in this particular universe that they inhabit, the only real limits of it are your imagination, and I mean you in particular, who's the creator of all of it. Will we be seeing anything more with these characters in the future? Is that a possibility, or is this sort of can Call Me King be considered a standalone piece?
It's definitely a possibility. There's still a lot more I have to say. If there is a sequel, there is a good chance there could be. If it is, it would happen overseas. It wouldn't happen in America. But yeah, there's definitely more I have to say, and you know, I do feel like there's still more story that can be told. There's still a lot of unanswered questions, and there's a lot of history with the characters that we haven't seen. You know, how they got to this point. How this these conflicts sort of what they were born out of, and how certain characters met. You know, there's definitely a lot of history there that I'd love to sort of show the audience and expand on.
Okay. Now, but I know in the interim, you're not limited to the Toy Pwin or the Call Me King universe. So aside from your endeavor with the Almighty Street Team, what do you have coming up? Like, what are you working on? What can people look out for?
Oh, man. There's definitely several properties in development right now. There's, of course, the Almighty Street Team, you know, which is the first sort of superhero action film from my company. And that's in development as we speak. And then there's also another feature film called Jasmine, which is a really unique piece that I'm working on. You know, because it has a Black Latina female lead. And it takes place in 1994, and it sort of combines like the classic hip-hop culture with a little bit of sci-fi, a little bit of you know, the music culture as well. It's really interesting, but it's a drama, but it does have action. Yeah, that's a really, really unique piece that I'm working on. And there's a hardcore martial arts film. I haven't really done a hardcore martial arts movie in a while. So there's a movie called The Grappler with that stars Kevin Lucada, R. Marcus Taylor, Andre Chana McCoy, Sam Poorfour, and several like other really great martial arts actors. So that's something that's in development as well.
Okay. Yeah, I'm definitely going to be looking out for that that last project you just mentioned. But at this juncture in the show, I kind of just want to give my feelings on the movie. And don't worry, I actually liked it. I think, I really did enjoy it. I watched it for the second time this afternoon. And I want to implore anybody out there, you know, if you see this on the marquee at your local multiplex, or if you happen to see it going through Walmart on Blu-ray and DVD, or if you happen to see it on video on demand, you may be tempted to just dismiss it as like a B movie full of no name actors that you don't care about. And I implore anybody who may think that to, you know, kind of check that at the door and give this movie a shot, because I think it's the kind of movie that will surprise a lot of people if they give it a chance, because the ambition is clear. The craft is definitely clear. As you look at the movie, you can tell that you're in the hands of someone who cares about the craft of filmmaking and cares about telling a coherent story, and who actually will take the time to use the resources that he has in a way that you can actually see those resources on the screen. The action especially is very well staged. The fight scenes, I was actually really shocked by how well staged some of those fight scenes were. The character dynamics, the interplay between the characters, again, a lot of time and a lot of care went into that stuff, and it's evident on the screen. I can't really say anything more about it. I really did enjoy this movie, and I implore everybody, if you like crime films, if you like action thrillers, if you like martial arts movies, give this a shot. You know, because I think a lot of people will be pleasantly surprised. I think they'll find themselves recommending it to other people. And I'm proud to say that, you know, I covered your work from a few years ago, and I'm also honored that you came to me and agreed to be on this show. And I'm proud to actually be one of the people letting everyone know about this product. I mean, you have a good movie on your hands, man.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that a lot.
I'll be doing my best to cheerlead for you on Facebook. Just like last week, I talked about how I'm part of the David Walker PR department. Now I'm part of the R.L. Scott PR department. But again, I take that as a badge of honor, because I have no problem standing behind a product I believe in, and I definitely think that as black people who make movies, and as black people who have an interest in film, even if you're not in the industry, if you're just a connoisseur like me, a guy who appreciates good movies, I have no problem lending a helping hand or allowing my show to be a platform for black artists who I think are putting out quality product and representing us well, not in the respect politics sense, not in the you're making black people look good sense, but in the you're putting out quality product sense, and you're definitely one of those guys, man.
Yeah, definitely appreciate that, brother. And there's actually an interesting fun fact that I do want people to know. All the actors in the film perform all of their own stunts and all their own fighting. You know, we didn't use any stunt doubles at all. Each of those actors, you know, trained and gave 150% to be able to perform those fight sequences. And we had some pretty rigorous fight sequences in the film. And, it was all them. You know, they all stepped up and really were willing to put it all on the line, you know. So I've always felt like it's more authentic when you can actually see the actor perform, you know what I mean? As long as it's nothing that's unsafe or anything that is too dangerous, and if they do have the ability to perform, it's always richer to see the actor actually do it themselves. And these guys, you know, they did an awesome job.
All right, so definitely shout out to your cast and crew. You know, that we always, on Scottscope, we definitely have an appreciation for that kind of stuff. We're down to the 30-second mark almost, so just want to implore my listeners, go out, Call Me King. It's going to be in release on Labor Day weekend, September 4th. Check it out if you can, and from that day forth, be on the lookout for it in whatever way you can consume it. On the screen, on the big screen, or, you know, buying the Blu-ray or DVD, streaming it, what have you. But whatever it is, make sure you do it legally. You know, don't cheat R.L. Scott out of what's due him, because he did a hell of a job with this movie. So Call Me King, it's out September 4th. Check it out. R.L. Scott, thanks for stopping by, and we'll see
you
next time.
Sounds good, brother. Thank you so much.
RL?
Yeah. Uh-huh, yeah.
All right, 1 second. Let me just end the episode here.